Hello and welcome to Images, a public affairs program on KRWG that looks at the art, the flavor, the cultures, and the people of New Mexico. Hi, I'm Carrie Hamblin, the host of Images. Thanks for tuning in for an exploration into the hidden treasures of our area. As a young boy, Spencer Crew remembers fondly family outings to historical places. Growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, his family would visit historic sites like a Shaker Village in Ohio or the Falling Timbers Battlefield. But also, his parents instilled an appreciation of his own family history. Spencer Crew is the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of History at George Mason University and is our guest today on Images. Spencer Crew enjoyed imagining the experiences of people who lived long ago on those family outings, learning about his own family history from his father, who was the youngest of 12 children and grew up in South Carolina, also provided Spencer with a great appreciation of history. He knew how his family relocated from South Carolina to Ohio and learned later in life that his family was part of the great migration of African Americans from the South to the North. Spencer Crew has worked in public history institutions for more than 25 years. He was president of the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center for 6 years and also worked at the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian for 20 years, nine of those as the director. His work at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center attracted worldwide attention because of the focus on race, interracial cooperation, and issues of contemporary slavery. Slavery actually dates back to 1501 when Spanish settlers brought slaves from Africa to the now capital of the Dominican Republic. However, in 1619, Africans were brought to Jamestown to work in Britain's North American colonies. Between 1619 and 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation was enacted, the anti-slavery movement existed in various forms, from the first publication of the book The Selling of Joseph, addressing the first North American anti-slavery tract, to banning of the slave trade in 1808, the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854, up to the Emancipation Proclamation by President Abraham Lincoln in 1863. Although the proclamation freed slaves in states that were in rebellion against the United States, it did not free slaves in states that never left the Union. During this time, slaves believed that wherever the Union Army arrived, there was a chance for freedom. However, this would cause enslaved people to rush the Union line seeking freedom. Spencer Crew says this changed the goal for the Union Army.
In the light of this, also, you have Union generals who begin to try have to figure out, as the Union troops go into the South and they're near plantations and then enslaved people come rushing to the Union lines, what do I do? How do I treat this? And early on, you have one general who decides that he's going to use an interesting approach. And the approach is that he's going to call these individuals contrabands of war. And essentially what this means is that a contraband is a person or a item that can be used by the enemy to help them fight against you. So by declaring slaves or enslaved people contrabands of war, you're saying, well, if I send them back, they'll be able to help the South continue to fight. But if I keep them, we're depriving them of an important resource. So therefore, I should not return these runaways to their slaveholders. And that technicality begins to make it more and more a choice by the Union Army to keep the runaways rather than send them back. Initially, the idea was that you'd send them back. But this shifts everything. The Emancipation Proclamation also makes this a much more complicated set of questions to figure out.
Well, didn't this also look like, the possibility of recruiting new soldiers to help in the war effort?
Yes, but that comes slowly. And that's not the first thing. The first thing that happens is that what you decide to do is to use them as workers for the Union Army. So they could be ditch diggers. They could build breastworks in order to repel fighters, to work as nurses, aides, a whole variety of sort of behind-the-scene battlefield labor support that's needed to free up soldiers not to have to do that. Eventually, it does result in the creation of colored troops in the Union Army. So this is sort of a first step in a series of stages to finally allow African-Americans to fight for their own freedom.
Well, in this part, though, and having those who were freed to become kind of behind-the-scenes workers, mm-hmm. That was all voluntary? I mean, did those...
Yes, it is voluntary. But, you know, the choice is now either I do this or do I go back to where I was or do I just... I don't have a clear set of choices now. So the best choice for me probably is to work for the Union Army, get paid, and maybe get clothing and food, or do I just wander off and try to figure out how to live my life suddenly free with no contacts, no support, nothing around me to help me survive?
Right, and many of them didn't have that. You know, it was just this is what I see right now as the light at the end of the tunnel. Past that, nothing concrete.
Well, if all you've ever known is slavery, and all you've ever known is the control of another individual over your life, and suddenly that's taken away, it's sort of, okay, now I've got to figure this out in a strange new environment, a strange new setting. So I think a lot of people are fairly pragmatic, and they say, I can get a job, I can get fed. If I have my family, I can have my family taken care of. So let me do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about those states that were in the Union that still had some semblance of slaves working?
The people who were in states that were still part of the Union, say a Maryland or even a Tennessee, technically under the Emancipation Proclamation, their slaves were still their slaves. And that became a bone of contention sometimes between slaveholders and the Union Army, because the slave would run away, and if it was in one of those states, the slaveholder would come and say, give me this person back. And you'd have various replies. Some would say, okay, that's my order. Here, you take him back. Others would say, no, we're not in the business of returning slaves to slaveholders. So it creates a lot of tension and a lot of turmoil around this question, because people don't feel good about sending people back into slavery.
Well, especially since the movement was just so rampant at the time
to not
do so. Our guest today on Images is Spencer Crew, who is the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of History at George Mason University. Well, something that was really big at this time was the Underground Railroad.
Yes.
That was used by slaves to escape. And it was such an intricate system.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to plan it today, you know, in terms of computers, I mean, just looking at the maps of the railroad routes.
Right.
I'm wondering, how did this system get developed? Because there was so much planning and protections in place to make sure that people weren't found out.
Well, it's an interesting process, the operation of the Underground Railroad, and I think sometimes we tend to give it more credit for the level of organization than may actually exist. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, the way I like to think about it is a group of independent contractors spread across the country who stay connected and involved in this process for varying amounts of time. Some do it for years. Some do it for decades. Some do it once and stop and don't do it ever again. So that it is really sort of a day-to-day, month-to-month operation with some key people who are sort of in it consistently. But otherwise, it's very loosely operated. I mean, I like to think of it like a spider web that has different pieces to it. So if you pull one piece out, it doesn't fall apart. But pieces will disappear, and then others will show up or not show up, and you have to keep adjusting it. So that it's really a system where, for most people, the idea is that if someone shows up at my doorstep who is running away, trying to gain their freedom, I am going to help them. And if I can connect them to someone else I know who can move them further on, we will do that. So it's a very loosely organized network of individuals that's constantly changing and alternating. We sometimes tend to think of one or two people as the norm, and they're not. I mean, Levi Coffin, who is in Ohio and Indiana, is a well-known Quaker involved in this, and he actually writes an autobiography in the 1880s or 1890s. And so his life story for many become the model for how the Underground Railroad operates, and he is involved for decades. And he does have a good network of individuals, many of them Quakers and others who he turns to. But in many ways, he's the exception, not the rule.
Mm.
That many others who are involved in it don't do it as regularly or as long, but are connected periodically. So I think we want to think of it as I said, a very loose network that's constantly changing, and players come in and out as part of it.
Well, could one of the reasons be that people were afraid of being found out, that they were, mm-hmm. you know, hiding freed slaves or people who were trying to escape?
Well, absolutely. I think that there is the concern that the law of the land at the time is opposed to having people help fugitives gain their freedom. You have two major laws that are in place. One is a fugitive slave law of 1793, and then a reinforced fugitive slave law in 1850. And in each of these, the whole idea is that it puts the force of the federal government in support of slaveholders or slave catchers sent north to return runaway slaves. And you are subject to a fine or subject to possible time in jail if you are found guilty of doing this. So that there is a real risk involved in this. The other part to this is that I think the players in the Underground Railroad who often get overlooked are people who are part of the African-American community. And for them, there are no laws that protect their rights or their property or their well-being. so that for them, slaveholders can just come to their door, burst in and say, we're looking for runaways, and tear the place apart. And if they find someone, they drag them off, and if you resist, if they shoot you, you're just shot. So there's a lot of danger connected with this, and I think that people have to weigh that very carefully to be a part of it. And those who commit are committing in a very strong kind of way, because the downside could be very, very painful, very difficult.
Well, one of those is Harriet Tubman, who's most commonly known for the Underground Railroad.
Absolutely, yes.
And so how did she become involved in the Underground Railroad?
Well, I think for Harriet Tubman, it's a very personal issue. I mean, she begins her life as an enslaved person on Maryland Eastern Shore. She has a very painful childhood as an enslaved person. I mean, before she's five, she's sent off to take care of the children of other people. Part of it is at night she's supposed to make sure the baby doesn't wake up and cry. And if she falls asleep and stops rocking the cradle and the baby starts to cry, she gets hit. And in one place, she's actually, before she's 7 or 8, her task is to go down to the river and to look for traps that have muskrats in them and pull them out of the river and take the dead muskrat out and bring it back up. This is a 7 or 8 year old. So her life is very difficult. Then the other one is, in fact, she's hit in the head with an iron when she gets in the way of an escaping young man. So that her life as an enslaved person is very difficult. And she eventually decides that she needs to gain her freedom, which she does do. But she also decides that she has family members who are still in slavery that she's going to go back and get. So that key for her is returning to help family members gain their freedom and others who might want to come along as well. So that what's driving her is, one, her belief that people should be free, but also her very strong belief that she has seen family members sold further south and she doesn't want that to happen to ones that she can help. She's going to go back and try to help them.
And so what a great risk of her own life that she takes to go back and get her family members.
Yeah, she's pretty fearless and pretty strong. Quite a remarkable woman in many, many ways. But part of what people have argued is that as she became older, she spent a lot of time working independently because she's just very strong. And she also spent a lot of time with her father, who actually knew how to operate in the woods. And he gave her a lot of skills in terms of how to navigate the woods and how to find north and the stars and everything else. Plus, she was connected into a group of sort of African-American watermen who live in eastern Maryland and so can also share with her different routes that they could follow. So that she has this network of individuals that she's connected to who can help her. She's been given the skills on how to travel at night in strange areas successfully. And those things combined with her just very strong character, very strong belief in God. She's a very religious woman. All combined to make her an amazing agent in the Underground Railroad and a very strong believer in helping others gain their freedom.
Well, I mean, given that she had access to these resources, I mean, and this is, you know, not with a computer, you know, I'm wondering, how did they get the information? How did they relay information to each other about this? Because it's, you know, I mean, messenger.
Oh, right. Well, you didn't send in things by telephone or through cell phone. Well, part of it is I had mentioned that she has this connection to these African-American watermen who are traveling up and down the waterways on the ocean between Baltimore and Philadelphia and other kind of places. So it gives you places, people you can give information to give to others. And there's also a connection to family members, so she still has down there, down in the South. So she's able to get information down to people saying, all right, I'm planning to come down this fall, so keep your eyes out for me. When I come, you need to get ready and come with me. So there's this informal network of communication that takes place, and she's not the only one who does that. That what's remarkable is how much communication there is back and forth between African-Americans who are living in the North and family and relatives they still have in the South. There is this sort of line of communication, partly because you have so many African-Americans who work on the waterways. And even if you're enslaved, you have to work on a riverboat or something like that going back and forth. And so you just say, well, you know where my mother is. Could you give my mother this message? And that becomes the way that things are transmitted back and forth. Plus, they also do use the mail sometimes using sort of
code
indirect messages as ways to get information to family members. Because what you have to keep in mind is that all letters that go south can be opened and read. So they have to figure out ways of transmitting information, knowing that they're going to be read, but that their reader won't understand.
Do you know what some of the examples would be of that? That
well, I'm aware of Harriet Tubman having decided that she was going to go back down to the Eastern Shore to get, I forget, one of her family members, and had a colleague who lived, I think, just outside of Baltimore, who she sent a letter to, not from her, but from someone else, and made a number of religious references that he understood meant that she was coming at a certain time. But if you just read them, it seemed like it was just a regular story. And if I remember the story correctly, the postmaster does open the letter, brings him in and says, "This is a letter for you." And he says, "I don't know who this is from." And he reads to me, "I don't know what's going on here. No, and you keep the letter. I don't even want it." But now it's been read to him. He understands the message and he's off to take care of that. So I don't know if that's the norm, but it's an illustration of the kinds of ways they found to communicate back and forth.
Well, and how would somebody get into the Underground Railroad? I mean, would it be known of people in the community if you were trying to obtain your freedom and were willing to take that risk of going on the Underground Railroad? Were there point people that, you know, somebody knew that they could go and talk to start that process?
It varies. The Underground Railroad is more often thought of as a northern-based operation as opposed to a southern-based one. And that's in part because I think we haven't had a chance to really study and understand how it might work in the South, because there are people in the South who are willing to help others gain their freedom. But for the most part, many slaves who run away and get north on their own. And then when they get to the north, you either by luck come in contact with someone who's connected with the Underground Railroad, or very often they'll go to the African American community. And there they'll hope that the person they run into will be sympathetic as opposed to willing to turn them in for the reward. And so it's a little bit of luck. Sometimes there's word of mouth in the area where you live. For example, Levi Coffin's very, very open about his involvement in it. Thomas Garrett, who lives in Delaware, is very open about it. William Still, who lives in Philadelphia, African-American, who's part of the anti-slavery society there, everyone knows that he's one of the players in this process. But otherwise, sometimes it's a matter of making a contact, often by luck, that then plugs you into a group of people who are willing to be helpful. So luck has a lot to do with this process.
Well, you know, in addition to this being, something that was somewhat organized, somewhat not organized, and
right.
There were some protections that were put into place that would really kind of protect people further on down the line in case somebody was found.
Well, I think the thing about the Underground Railroad is that very few people know everyone who's a part of it. So that, again, it's sort of like the spider web. So if you grab one part and you've got that information, it doesn't mean you're going to be able to connect to the other ones very easily. And I think the protections are trying to be quiet and low-key about your involvement, not getting a lot of attention, and having a variety of options and routes in which people can go so you can mix it up. And if you know that people are going one way to look for runaways, you can send them a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our guest today on Images is Spencer Crew, who is the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of History at George Mason University. So let's kind of jump ahead to the early 1900s, and that's where freed slaves were now facing employment in areas other than fields or in homes.
Right.
And so what was the picture like for those who were able to escape and who were in the North and were now free to try and find their own employment and their own way of taking care of themselves?
Right. Well, I think post Civil War, if you go into Reconstruction and then post Reconstruction, it's difficult. The majority of individuals, African Americans in the nation after the Civil War up through 1900, actually into the 20th century, live in the South in rural areas, so that they continue to be mostly agriculturally oriented. The challenge is the fact that they're facing not having control over the land. That one of the things that enslaved people requested consistently coming out of the Civil War is that we want to own land. If we can own land, then everything else will follow. But if we don't control the land, it means the people who we had to work for when we were enslaved have control over our lives again. And that didn't happen. That land was not provided for those who were formerly enslaved, even though their labor had made the people who owned the land rich. And so the difficulty becomes trying to survive, especially in the South and rural areas after that time. And there are systems that then come into place like sharecropping and tenant farming that essentially continue to keep them under the control of the landowners. And so that their lives are very difficult, very challenging, not very wealthy. And in some ways, the system of slavery that existed before just transforms itself into a different form and keeps them under the economic control of people who control the land. So it's a very difficult time for individuals. And going north, it begins to become more industrialized, but going north is not getting to a nirvana, because there's prejudice there. There's a sense that African Americans are not as good as other individuals. Their opportunities for jobs are very much limited to mostly lower-level, domestic, backbreaking kind of work. So even there, the struggle for survival is very hard, because they're not the opportunities that women like to have to be able to take care of your family and to have a good life. So life in the United States for African Americans, even after the Civil War and into the 19th, 20th century, is still a very difficult struggle.
I'm wondering, what was it that you found would be the core that would give people the strength, the hope to continue, even though things seem to be so dismal
and
many. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's you know, to have your freedom is priceless. But then when when you continue to have these barriers put up, you know, it seems it's so contradictory.
Well, it is. And I think part of it, obviously what's important is the church and religion and belief in God, a belief in maybe a better life later, a belief that if you persevere, that things will get better along the way. So that's important. But I think in the midst of all this, that African Americans are creating their own communities. And in those communities, you can create sort of a bubble in which you can have friends and connections and activities and a social life and other things that help you sort of navigate and feel a little bit better about the world in which you have to live. It also provides a space where you can provide some protection for your children from those kind of issues that are to face them going forward, and to help them to prepare for that. So that I think it is a belief that you just have to keep going forward, and that working hard and keeping your nose to the grindstone, you try to make a way as best you can. As they say, phrases, making a way out of no way.
Hmm. Well, what were the cities that were more open to welcoming freed slaves after the 13th Amendment went into place?
Well, certainly living in a city, in any city, is better than living in the rural areas, just because the communities are more closely knit together. It's a little bit harder for people to have control over your life if there's a large number of African Americans as opposed to people living in isolated areas in the South. So that I'd say that at least getting to cities was a step in the right direction, north or south. That meant your life was a little bit different, a little bit better. But I think in all of those cities, the challenges are very steep, and the opportunities that are available are very hard. I mean, the plus to it is that, especially in areas we have large numbers of African Americans, you can have a professional class to arise of doctors, of dentists, of store owners and people like that who cater to the African American community. So you do have a middle class that arises who are able to provide services to the African American community that are being denied to them in other places. So I think those are some of the pluses that emerge. And the other thing is that in those communities, because of their mixture, I think you have better sort of a variety of examples of lifestyles that people can follow. So you have, you know, people who are doing really well and people who are struggling together and working together in ways that probably later on, as you get deeper into the 20th century, begin to fall apart in some ways.
How so?
Well, I think that what some people have argued is that as you get into the 1960s and the Great Society of Johnson's, that in part what he begins to do is to pull apart the fabric of the African-American community by providing opportunities that take the middle class and the wealthier residents out of that community. And you create a split in the community. You don't have that variety of individuals living together and offering a variety of examples to youngsters as they grow up. And it just sort of reinforces a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So if you're in a community where everybody struggles, the belief that children have is that life is a struggle. If you have a community where you have some people who are struggling, others are doing well, children can see the opportunity and say, well, maybe there's a chance for me to do this. And I think by sort of separating those communities out, or the opportunity to do that, makes it harder and more challenging for those who are left to in the struggle.
Well, with this, with much of your work has been on the whole migration from the South to the North, and I'm wondering, through your research, finding, I mean, you say that many of African Americans are still residing in the South, and so what have you found through your research as to what prompts people to leave that security of that community, of what they mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. to going to another area that may be just as challenging? You know, the laws are in place that you have your freedom, but may still be just as challenging.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the same for African Americans as it is for anyone. They're going looking for opportunity. So if you can find a location where there are jobs available, where there's a chance for maybe your children to get a better education, where maybe the chance to have decent housing is a little bit better, that people try to take advantage of those opportunities. And there are sort of times in history when those opportunities arise in more kind of concrete ways. For example, with the Great Migration in the first part of the 20th century, World War I is an important watershed, because there are all of a sudden now jobs, especially in northern industry and in big cities and in seaport, that hadn't existed before, because soldiers are being siphoned off to go fight in the war. Immigration from Europe to this country is cut off because of the fighting. And so there's a real need for workers in these industries. And this provides opportunities for African Americans, and actually, I should say also for poor whites, to get access to jobs they couldn't get before. So part of what happens is that when you hear there's a chance to get at work, you take advantage of it. Because if you're making a dollar a day as a farm laborer in Alabama, and you're paying $5 a day in the shipping yards of Philadelphia, you might want to go and give it a shot, because you think in the long haul it'll be better off for you and your family. So I think it's the search for opportunity. Also a search for better opportunity for your family going forward. So also, if you can go to some place where in fact you can go to high school and go to a good school, as opposed to one where their books are, you know, 20 years old, right. You also look at those things as well. So what people balance out are, what are the possibilities for where I might go versus what are the challenges for where I am now, and do I have the means and the opportunity to actually take advantage of it?
Well, and we see that now with people from Mexico trying to come up to the United States for the same reason.
Absolutely.
Well, Spencer, I'm wondering, how do we learn from those race relations and interracial cooperation that occurred then, and provide them, you know, and apply them today? Because it's still not where we need to be.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we've learned or not. I mean, I think what one could argue is that certainly there have been improvements in the quality of life, the laws that exist, and the opportunities available to people. But I think that what we want to learn is that this is a sort of normal process in the history of the United States, that it is normal for new groups to come searching for opportunity and going wherever they can to have access to that. And that it's, I think we need to see that as a normal part of how we operate. That's part of the thing that's made the country interesting, that it's made it diverse. And I think the diversity is a strength of our country. And sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we're so focused on how things are now and not wanting to have change, not wanting to see different faces, that in fact it is the normal part of who we are as a nation. And if we embrace that, we have a chance, I think, to take advantage of all of the skills and all of the brain power that's in our population. And it sort of doesn't make sense to not do that. And we sometimes forget that because we get so focused on other issues, other characteristics, other things that we think make a big difference that really don't, and in the long run could hurt us as a country. So the question and the learning possibility is to recognize, looking back, how different groups have gone through this process and how it has made the country better over the long haul, and to continue to embrace that possibility.
Well, Spencer Crewe, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
I enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
Spencer Crewe is the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of History at George Mason University. He is the author of several books, including Unchained Memories, Readings from the Slave Narratives, available from Bullfinch Press. It was also made into an HBO documentary. bringing together more than 40 recollections from more than 2,000 interviews conducted by the WPA during the Depression. If you'd like to hear this program again or others, you can find them all on our website. Go to krwg.org. Thanks for tuning in tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll tune in again next week at 5:30 for another Images, right before a Prairie Home Companion on 90.7 KRWG Las Cruces.